นมัสตุรัตนตยัสสะSo welcome everyone. This is my first talk in Second Life. Truth be told, this is my first week in Second Life. And today I thought I would give a talk about, well, something to do with Second Life, with virtual reality in general, and sort of how it relates to non-virtual reality, or what we think of as real life. And so my talk today will be entitled Fundamentals of Reality. And I'll also be hopefully posting this as an MP3 to my website, and we'll try to get that link out to everybody. So my talk is going to set it up in three parts. The first part is on the difference between reality and illusion, and telling the difference, and how to understand what is reality and what is delusion. The second part is going to be why this is important, why it's important to us as human beings, why it's important to us as meditators, why it's important to us in the search for happiness and freedom from suffering. And the third part is what we should do, what we got to do about it, what we should be, how we should be reacting. So I don't know how long it's going to take. I've never done this before. Hopefully it won't go over half an hour. If it's not a half an hour, then we'll just do some meditating. So without further ado, I'll start. So first of all, I want to say that I think a place like Second Life is a really good demonstration of some of the points I'm going to be making. I mean, we're all clear on the fact that pretty much everything here is illusion. I mean, we're not really sitting here in a room together. I think we're probably all pretty clear about that. But what we're doing is we're intentionally deceiving ourselves. We're trying to make it look to ourselves as though that's exactly what we're doing. We're coming together, or we're turning on the computer, and we're looking at these pixels, whether it's plasma inside a notebook screen or whether it's rays in a cathode tube, and we're purposefully creating an illusion. Now we don't always do this in real life, but it is in fact exactly what's happening. So in Second Life here, we have, or in virtual reality, we have sight and we have sound. And so you hear the sound, you think it's me talking. Well, it's actually your speakers or your earphones vibrating. But in real life, it's actually no better, because when we see things, we're not actually seeing a person. We're seeing light touching the eye, of course. And so we are actually deceiving ourselves in a way, or we're extrapolating on what it is that we're really seeing. And we're saying that that's a person, and that's this thing and that thing, and we're recognizing it, and we're liking it and disliking it, and so on. So just to sort of set the tone of exactly what I'm going to explain as being real. And it's actually very little. Most of what we think is real is actually solely created in our minds. You know, when we see something, it's light touching the eye. And in fact, if you do any study on this, if you look up the work of Alva Noy, I think, Kevin Reagan, I think is the other one, what they realize is that when we see something, we're actually not really seeing all of it anyway. We're just seeing pieces of it, and it's our mind that's putting it together. Our mind is extrapolating at least 50%, if not more. And that's how we get this picture. So pretty much everything we think is real is actually an extrapolation in our minds. And what's real is very, very little. And the example that they give of this in the ancient texts is of a rope. And I think probably a lot of people have had this experience where you walk into a dark room, or maybe not even a dark room, but you step on a rope and you suddenly scream or jump or freak out thinking it was a snake. And then when you look down and you see it's a rope, you think of how silly you were. But it makes it clear how our minds play incredible games with us. And so what I think it's important to realize is that this is what we're doing all the time. We're not necessarily as a bad thing. I don't want it to be understood that illusion is in and of itself a bad thing. I'm just going to talk about some of the dangers that can come from not realizing, not seeing the difference between reality and illusion. So I think this makes it pretty clear exactly what is unreal. Pretty much everything. All the people that we see, all the things that we encounter are just labels we give to an experience in our minds. When we hear a sound, we say that's Yuta Dhammo, or that's Delaney, or that's Faith, or that's Zeno, or whoever. When we see someone, we say the same thing. But in truth, all it is seeing. And so, next I'd like to explain exactly what it is that, according to the theory and the practice that I follow, what is real. And how we start to approach what is real is by understanding what we call the six senses. Now, most of us know about the five senses. People who are familiar with Buddhist practice probably know what are the six senses, but for many people, we think of the sixth sense as some kind of extrasensory perception or so on. Actually, the sixth sense is just the mind. It's just the thinking. It's not really that important, or it's not really that special. Of course, on the other hand, it is quite important and quite special, but in a different way, and I'll explain why. The six senses are seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, feeling, and thinking. And every experience, every bit of reality can be broken down, can be categorized into one of these six things. Now, I don't know, I've thought sometimes that there might be a seventh or eighth sense that could appear or suddenly evolve into being, and I think that's perfectly possible, but I think six is a fine framework to sort of get an understanding of what is real and what is not. So when we see something, actually all that's real about it is the seeing, that's the framework in which we have to put it. When we see something we like or something we dislike, it's actually just seeing. So sitting here right now looking at the screen, what's actually happening is there's a seeing going on. There's an experience of seeing. When you hear, there's an experience of hearing. When you smell, there's an experience of smelling. When you taste, tasting. When you feel, feeling. When you think, thinking. But what happens when we see is it's not just a simple process of seeing. I mean, in the beginning there's the light and there's the eye. And then there's the mind which sees it. That's where it starts, but that's unfortunately not where it ends. Because when we see something, right away we remember what it is. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that, as we remember or we recognize it. So there's still nothing wrong here when we recognize this is the sound of the monk, or this is the sound of the friend, or my mother, or my father, or so on. But once we remember, then we start to judge about it. You know, we feel happy about it, or we feel unhappy. So maybe you hear my sound, and it feels like I have a calm sound. Or maybe you hear my sound, and I'm stuttering, or I'm pausing, or saying a lot, and it jars on your senses, and you don't like that. And this is where the problem starts. So the problem is never in the experience itself. When we see, when we hear, when we smell, when we taste, when we feel, even when we think, the problem is not in the experience itself. The problem is when it is then processed by the mind and given a judgment as either good, bad, or me, or mine, or should be, shouldn't be, wish it were, wish it weren't, and so on. This is where the problem arises. This is where the problem starts. And it's summed up by the expression making mountains out of molehills. Well, reality is really like a molehill. There's really not much to it. It's actually an incredible, reality is actually an incredible thing, and I don't want to discount that, but it's made up of very simple building blocks. Just as in science we know, or we used to believe that there were things like atoms in the physical realm, but now they've got all theories about strings and so on. In the mind, it's the same. We've got a sort of set of building blocks, and it's a very simple set, and it creates this wonderful illusion that we all live in. So then, why then is this important, and why is this potentially problematic? And here we have to get into talking about some of the problems that exist in the world. I know often we come to Second Life to get away from our problems. I like to say, sorry, you've come to the wrong place. Buddhism is not about running away from your problems, and we don't allow that here. So you've ran away to the wrong place if that's what you're trying to do. In fact, here we are coming to face and to coming to understand our problems. The reason why we have all types of mental sickness, mental illness, mental suffering, is because of misunderstanding. Because we don't understand the reality which is around us. We see something and we don't understand it, what's going on. We don't know how to react. We don't know how to react because we don't know what it is. You know, someone yells at us and right away we either don't know how to react, or we react in a very poor way. A way which doesn't bring us happiness, which doesn't bring happiness to the other person, which doesn't solve the situation. And the only thing you can say about this is it's based on misunderstanding. If it were based on understanding, it wouldn't lead to suffering. Anything that's based on wisdom can't, by definition, lead to suffering. It wouldn't be wise, it wouldn't be wisdom then. So what happens when we diversify, or we make more of something than actually is that we then come to like it or dislike it. We make a judgment about it, and then it's categorized into something which is going to bring us pleasure or going to bring us displeasure. And the physiology of it is that it's causing all sorts of chemical reactions in our brain. This talks about dopamine and testosterone and sorry, not testosterone, adrenaline. You know, the whole fight or flight, or the sexual desire, the sensual desire. These are all sorts of chemical reactions going on in the brain, and these have very strong repercussions on our physiology. They create addiction, and they create suffering. They create states of withdrawal when we don't get what we want. States of depression, states of anxiety, states of stress, fear, neurotic, obsessive behaviors. And we see this all the time. I mean, we see it in our relationships with other people, with people that We say we love, although in the end it just turns out to be an attachment. With people who we hate, people who we fear, and with situations and experiences which are uncomfortable to us. We simply don't understand them, and so we come to crave or want for something that isn't. We want this to go away, or we want this to stay. We want it to do something that it's not going to do. We want it to do something that is contrary to its nature, contrary to the way it really is, because we don't understand it as it really is. And so we chase and we try to build things up to be stable, to be satisfying, to be under our control. And they never are. And the nature of things in the world is to change. And think about it, you know, when everything is set to change, and here we are creating these states in our mind, these chemical reactions in our brains that are basically saying, let it stay, let it stay, hope it stays forever, or don't let it come back, hope it doesn't come back, go away, go away. Now, is it possible that we could be happy when things don't go our way, when things don't go according to those wishes? This is why suffering arises. This is why depression, anxiety, this is why people kill themselves. It's amazing. Some of you might be amazed to find out how many people, come to suicide, thoughts of suicide, based on these things, based on very simple chemical and mental reactions to very simple things. I've been teaching people over the internet for a while now, using Skype, and you know, you can really change people's way of looking at things when you're able to explain to them about reality, and help them to understand the difference between reality and illusion. So this is the second part, talking about why this is important. The third part is, well, what's the answer? Or what can we do about this? In Buddhism, we understand the root of everything as taught by the Lord Buddha, the root of everything, or the root of all, let's say, the root of all suffering, the root problem, let's say, is ignorance. As I've explained, it's because we don't understand, it's because we misunderstand. But I like the word ignorance because it reminds us of the word ignore. It's not that we just don't know, it's that we're really ignoring the reality of the situation, the reality of our lives. We're ignoring reality. I think this is a funny talk to give in Second Life because everyone's like, duh, yeah, that's why we're here. But maybe it's not why we're here. Maybe we're really here to find a better way. Because we're searching. Because our ordinary ignorant state of being is not satisfying. And so we're here wondering if this might be the way. Wondering if it's really possible to find a way to live our lives without suffering, without stress. And there's probably a lot we can get away from by coming here, and we can avoid, and it's probably in many ways an easier sort of platform for us to develop good qualities of mind. I don't think that should be a replacement for real and true understanding of any type of reality, whether it's virtual or whether it's real. I think you can practice meditation in Second Life just as easily as you can in the real life, as long as you're aware of what's real about the experience. I don't think there's really any difference between what we call real life and what we call Second Life. So It's simply by neglecting, by failing to pay attention, by failing to give importance to reality, that we fall into suffering, that we fall into stress. So what we have to do is remind ourselves. Remind ourselves of what's real, remind ourselves what's really going on, remind ourselves of what it is we're really faced with. And this is the core of Buddhist practice. Many of you have probably heard about this tool we call mindfulness. And you may have, some of you may have already heard some of the Buddhist teachers moaning and groaning about what a horrible translation it is of the original word. And I've heard this across the board. I don't think it's something that I'm just feel myself. In general, there's an agreement that the word sati or smriti, as it's called in Pali and Sanskrit, does not mean mindfulness. It's mindfulness is maybe one aspect of the word sati or smriti, but it's not a direct translation. And I'll go over a little bit of the etymology just shortly here. Sati, the Pali word, which I'm more familiar with, and its equivalent in Sanskrit, smriti, comes from, in Pali anyway, the verbal root sar, which means to remember or recollect. And so when you sar, sarati means to remember or recall, bring to mind. And so it can be used to remember something in the past. It can be used for remembering something that you have to do in the future. But in Buddhist meditative practice, of course, it refers to remembering the present moment, remembering now. And it's very curious. I think we can all get this. I think it's not difficult to understand that, and most of the time we're not here and now. I mean, it seems silly to talk about remembering where we are and what we're doing, but we're really not. We're not aware of what we're doing. You're all sitting here, your mind is wandering, it's going here and there, and you're not really aware of everything that's going on. Maybe in your home there's something going on, somebody's disturbing you, maybe you're doing something else while you're listening to me. Maybe you're not even listening. We're not really in the here and now at all times, for sure we're not. We forget it a lot. And specifically, we forget the core of the experience. So when someone yells at us, we forget that it's simply sound touching our eardrums. So we don't have the chance, even if we wanted to understand and to, stop ourselves from getting angry, stop the eventual reaction, which is totally negative. So in Buddhism, we're simply reminding ourselves, using the word sati, we're reminding ourselves of who we are, what we're doing, reminding ourselves of what's happening here and now. And the way we do this, if some of you are familiar with the way I've been teaching, I know there are different ways of approaching this, but the way I understand it and the way I've been taught is sati, remembering, or reminding yourself, is done with a word. And I don't think this is at all out of line with traditional meditative practices. I mean, we know that Hindu meditations in ancient times were very much based on a mantra. You see the Om symbol around here. Om means, or Om is a very traditional mantra in the Hindu tradition. What is a mantra? Mantra is a word that has power. Manta. Manta is mant. The root is mant, which means to counsel, to advise, to give words, or to have a word. So a mantra is something that we. Is the word that we have, the word that we use, the word that we give to something. And it had all these different connotations, like casting spells on people and so on. But it came to be used as a meditative tool, and it's a very effective one. It's nowadays used in many different religious traditions as a tool to calm the mind. So in Buddhism, we say Buddho, Buddho. We talk about the Buddha. We use the Buddha as our word. In Hinduism, these Om. Some of these Om Shanti, Shanti, and so on. Some of these different mantras. But in insight meditation, or in the core meditation of the Buddhist teaching, the mantra that we're using, or the word that we're using, which gives great power to your focus, which allows you to focus on the object with great power, we turn this then back on reality. And we have a word which reminds us of the reality in front of us. Now, what's going on? When you're listening to me, we have a word for that. Remind yourself of the reality of it. So that when someone yells at you and you're like, here we go again, here I'm going to flip out at them. Instead, just say to yourself, hearing. Remind yourself of what's really going on. And I know many people have talked about how this seems like a weird way to go about meditating. Mostly they like just sitting there and not thinking about anything. But I mean, try it out and see how it works, and think about it. I mean, what you're doing is you're fixing on something that you're not really getting, or you're not really giving importance. You're not really aware of. When you hear something, the last thing you're aware of is that you're hearing. You're totally lost in what the other person is saying. Your mind is nowhere near your ear. It's all over the place. Judging, liking, disliking, thinking about the past, thinking about the future. It's not here, it's not now. So we have a whole meditation technique based on this, on simply reminding ourselves of everything. When you feel pain, suppose you're sitting, I mean, none of us are probably sitting in the lotus position in real life, though I was there before. When you're sitting in the meditative position, sometimes you can have a lot of pain. Well, instead of trying to adjust your position so you don't have pain, or maybe do yoga so that you don't feel the pain or so on. Instead, let's just become comfortable with it. Remind ourselves of the reality of it, because you can never really escape pain. It's always going to come back. When we get old, when we get sick, it's just going to come back. So running away is not going to solve things. What we're doing in essence is becoming friends with the reality. We're friends with the pain, coming to accept and to understand it and to appreciate it for what it is. So when you feel the pain, just say to yourself, pain, pain, pain. Reminding yourself again and again as like a mantra meditation that focuses on the reality. It's not pushing anything away. It's reminding yourselves of what's really there. It's not avoiding anything. But what it does then is it cuts off the extrapolation. There's no room in your mind. Your mind is full. And that's where the word mindfulness comes from, because your mind is full. It's full of reality. It's full of awareness about what's really going on. There's no room for this is good, this is bad. No, this is seeing, or this is hearing, or this is thinking. This is liking, this is disliking. And it doesn't go on to the next step, whatever that is. So, this is sort of an introduction to the foundations of reality, the fundamentals of reality. And I'd hope to get into a little bit of some of the things that you can expect to come across in meditation. But I think, I'm probably going to be giving quite a few talks here at Second Life if I don't get, or if the coordinators are still happy for me to give talks in the future. Probably I'll be giving talks Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and Tuesday, and Thursday of every week. So that's about a half an hour. I'll open it up to everyone. Did everyone hear that? I didn't just talk for a half an hour. Nobody heard it, did they? Okay. Great, great. Okay. Thank you. So yeah, well that's okay. Yeah, just here. That's good. My one of my teachers, he would always say, you know, the best way to listen to a Dhamma talk is to just sit there and say, hearing, 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 until it's over. He said, you don't need to listen to it. If you already know how to meditate, just meditate. Anyway, so I'll open it up to questions now. I've got another half an hour to sit around and answer questions, though I don't imagine, I don't know if it'll, don't think it would go that long. If possible, try to keep the questions sort of focused on either what I spoke or things that are generally related to it. If you have any personal questions or if you're uncomfortable asking questions in front of a group, after that I'll be heading back to my new wonderful kuti, which is a small, or actually a fairly large, hut or bungalow situated below the Buddha up on the mountain, on the right of the platform leading up up there. And you're welcome to come on over, and we can sit on the balcony and talk, or and that could be a more general discussion, or if you want to meet one-on-one inside my kuti, that's fine. I'll be around for a little bit in the afternoon if that. That comes up. I think this is a great way to teach. I'm really happy to be here, and so I do hope that people will make the best use of it, and we can progress in the meditation through this platform. So thanks a lot for showing up, and give me your questions if you got any, or if you didn't like it, just tell me. If there's nothing but reality, how can there be illusion? Is existence pure reality? How then even are delusions a reality, maybe? Where are we? In the local chat, no? Okay. Well, there isn't illusion. I mean, that's why we call it illusion. Hello? There. When we say illusion, we're talking about a reality which is a misunderstanding of reality, the reality of the thought. So an illusion is a mind state which says A is B, when in fact it's not. It's just a thought that arises in the mind. It's, there is no illusion. We call it illusion. It's a way of talking about something that doesn't exist. That's why we call it illusion. The thought that there is this, when this is an illusion, is just a thought, and that's real. The thought is real. But the illusion, the object of the thought, is not real. Well, like a rabbit with horns. Can everyone think of a rabbit with horns? Sure, but it doesn't exist. But the thought, the picture, the experience of a rabbit with horns, that exists. And the actual rabbit with horns doesn't exist. I mean, unless you count the jackalope. How are we responsible for this mess? Nobody asked to be born, and wouldn't delusion be more precise than illusion? Aren't we just sort of bonkers? Well, yeah, delusion is why we think illusion is real. They're not the same thing. An illusion is something that doesn't exist. Delusion is the belief that something is other than it really is. As far as a beginning, now I'm not an expert on beginnings, and the Buddha was not keen on talking about beginnings other than simple ignorance. And I guess that means that the beginning is ignorance. I mean, we just don't know. It's like somebody was asking, why aren't we all enlightened? Why do we start out unenlightened? And it's kind of like saying, maybe I'm misunderstanding your question, but if I could just let me finish the thought at least. Why aren't we all born with PhDs would be the answering question. It's, you know, enlightenment means some kind of learning and it requires some beginning. But sorry, your question was, maybe we make a mess, but I didn't make any of it. How do you mean that? You mean there's a mess in the world, but you weren't responsible for it? Nobody asks to be born. Well, I guess the problem is there is that in Buddhist thought, yes, we do ask to be born. I mean, when we die, we're not finished. We're not like, okay, that was enough. I'm square even with this. I mean, we've got a lot of stuff going on in our mind at the moment of death, and so there's no stopping at that moment, and that's why we're born. It's not like, poof, God poofs us into existence or something. When we finish this life, we're not square. You know, we're not like, okay, settled my debts, that's it. There's still a lot going on in our minds. Well, there is no reincarnation. There's no death. If you want my thoughts on it, you could go and visit my YouTube channel. And the question is, if there is no self, then what is reincarnated? Well, there is no death. I mean, death is a bodily thing. It's like waves crashing in an ocean, crashing against the shore. The ocean doesn't change. Just like when we die, the mind keeps going. I mean, as I said, reality is the six senses, and those don't change. Those don't suddenly disappear at death. Only this body, which really we only see from the outside, that's what ceases. Internally, there's still the six senses going on and on and on. And that's where scientists fail, because they only talk about the body. So how is the mind different to self? Okay, if I can answer one at a time. How is the mind different to self? Well, self would imply that it's permanent, when actually mind is something that arises and ceases, something that changes, something that comes and goes. You know, every mind state we could call a mind. And the self would mean it would be under our control, it would mean it's... But wouldn't this constructed consciousness cease as well? Well, it does cease. It ceases at every moment, but... You know, see, the point is that the body doesn't cease. The body is only an illusion. Bodily phenomena keep arising and ceasing in a sequence, just like the waves. I mean, death is just something you see from the outside. It's not something you see from the inside. I mean, can anyone say they've experienced death and that was it? I mean, it's only something we look at somebody and say, oh, I guess that was it. I mean, it's just a guess. So I guess it's a fairly educated guess, but not if you're into meditation, not if you've come to understand or come to see that, oh, the mind exists as well. Well, you know, and the body actually really doesn't. Like, sometimes you sit in meditation and the body just disappears. If you've ever had that experience, it's kind of awakening. So you think we can remember past lives? I don't know, you can give it a try, apparently. I've got a way to practice if you want to try it. Apparently it works. I've had people tell me that it works. And then the answer, so the mind continues after death. Yeah, yeah. I mean, Why wouldn't it? It's a pretty common thing in the in Eastern traditions to just not believe in death. I mean, yeah, death is just a transition. I think that's very well said. It's like getting out of one car and into another car or something. Yeah, I don't follow the Diamond Sutra, so I probably can't comment on whether on what it says. I'm sure that there's an explanation for that. It probably doesn't mean what you think it is. You would think it means, although I can't say. So mind is reborn into a new body. Yeah, possibly. I mean, it's not exactly like reborn. It creates. I mean, we're creative beings. We create more. I mean, there's a process of creation going on, and so that's what we talk about coming into the womb. I mean, if you're born as an angel, then no, there is no new body. There's an arising as an angel or as a ghost or in hell or so on. But as animals or humans, yeah, we've got this pretty heavily constructed or formed existence, which is very specific and very structured. What happens with the mind when a person is in a coma? Yeah, I don't know. And there's states of mind which are very much like not having a mind. Sleep is one of those, deep sleep. But it's still a state of mind. It's just sort of like the pilot light. You know how a pilot what a pilot light is in a stove? It's always on. Or, you know, it's the mind, of course, is not always on, but this is a state of mind which is very, very weak. We can see this in regular experience. Sometimes someone says something to us and we sort of hear it, but not really. We're focused on something else, and then we have to ask them again, "What did you say?" That's called a weak experience or a weak taking of an object. There's taking great object, taking something with great attention, taking something with weak attention, and there's states which just don't take anything specifically as an object. It's like a sleep state. So I suppose a coma, I don't know if you ever saw that movie or that series, The Odyssey, a long time ago, back when I watched television. It was a guy in a coma and he was still dreaming, so I don't really know how a coma goes, but it could be any state of mind. Sometimes people experience sleep paralysis when their mind is fully awake and they can see and hear and feel because the mind is awake but the body is still asleep. Yeah, that's pretty common for meditators especially. Do you think death is like that to some extent? You look at the person experiencing SP and as far as you're concerned, they're asleep but they're only half awake. Yeah, well, death is one moment. I mean, I don't even know if you could put, well, I guess we do in Buddhism put a moment. When you say that, that's death, and it's a moment where the link to the body is gone, or the body is no longer functioning as giving rise to new minds or so on, new mind states. But right after that moment, then you know anything, any number of things could happen. I mean, sometimes you're people who have done bad, very, very bad things or very, very good things will have an image, a picture of that good thing that they did. Sometimes they'll have an image of the place where they're headed. Some people have whole stories where they see themselves floating off to their new location, their new rebirth, their new destination. Sometimes people, you know, they'll see symbols of things they've done, like if someone who was a murderer, they might see a knife or a gun. They might see blood. I've heard many meditators talking about these sort of things when they're sitting in meditation. If they've ever, you know, people who have ever done bad things will maybe see blood in their meditations. And this is the sort of thing that can come up when you die, and that's a very potent sort of relinking. It sends you on your way. There would have to be some you, some self. there for there to be death to begin with. So to unravel the secret of death, yeah, that's not a question, right? I saw something on TV about people recalling past lives and recall when they can't move and they realize they're dead. Yeah, I mean, that's common. Scientists, of course, have ways of discounting that sort of thing, but yeah, I mean, for sure. Sounds valid to me. I've heard people who said they've died already and they saw a lot of stuff, angels and so on, and they said they're not afraid of death now. They know when they die, they're going to a good place. I mean, as Buddhists, we're like, I wouldn't be so sure. But, you know, it's interesting that, you know, the things they've seen and the experiences they've had, it could all just be I'm inclined to think that it's all just going on in the mind and, yeah, near-death experiences. But I'm inclined to think that it's still something going on in the mind, and it's simply the mind sort of working in the sandbox, something like Second Life, where you go off and you want to build a house, you put it together, and then you put it somewhere, right? It's kind of like, this is the stage of the building stage, and then, okay, go. You know, res. What is the nature of reality? Is it the idea that there is no separateness or individual self? Physics seems to think that we are all part of a unified energy field that just manifests as separate in the level of reality that we exist in. Yeah, some physicists, and I know a lot of Hindus and even a lot of Buddhists, this belief that there is no individuality. I guess I don't have a lot to say about that, except I work a lot more on the individual level because most of us are sort of in that sort of framework. So I would say every individual has problems that have to be dealt with, and sort of dealing with those issues and problems and misunderstandings. So I'm not really, it's never seemed very useful in my work to talk about how we are all one. It's more talking about the individual and how they shouldn't look at things as self, but in a different way, in terms of not being able to control them. So learning to give up control, not sort of this we are one stuff, that can often simply be just covering up the problems and trying to create states of experience, you know, where experience we are one, but it's of course temporary. Here we're trying to understand the emotions, which are very, very much going on in the individual's mind. You know, my emotions are not your emotions, for instance. You're not experiencing my anger, I'm not experiencing your greed, or so on. And so we're not looking, I'm not trying to say that, you know, we are not, or that we are separate. It's not an issue of whether us and them, it's an issue of the problems that are arising and how to approach them. Because it's my mind, or it's this mind which is experiencing them, to sort of help to let go of the idea of me and mine. More so than to have some added conception of we are one kind of thing. I think it's a little bit of a different concept of self. Although I think there is something to be said for not separating into us and them, for instance. Remove the arrow before finding who shot it kind of thing. Yeah, I mean, I like that simile. It's one the Buddha used. I guess it could be useful here. I'm a little confused. If the mind can be reborn into another body and thereby have past lives, then how is it that different to having a self? On the other hand, if the mind is impermanent, then there is no mind either. Right, there's no mind either. There's only the mind states. And these mind states work in a stream, and so we call them the mind. There is no the mind. It's just like there is no the body. Just when we take, just like, I meant to talk about this, I kind of skipped over it. When we talk about the body, of course, we're talking about various different cells, and those cells can even be broken up into smaller and smaller pieces. And in the end, we can't find the body at all. The same goes with the mind. You know, we break the mind up into smaller and smaller parts, and in the end, we can't find the mind either. And it's scientific in the very same way. I think it's a sad that that scientists don't... I suppose there probably are some, but in general, from what I've seen, they're not that much interested in the mind as a scientific entity, because you can't use all your tools. Math doesn't work on the mind. I mean, I suppose you could even develop some kind of math for the mind, but you know, physics doesn't work on the mind, to put it bluntly. But what I want to say is there are very specific laws which do work on the mind. Yeah, just a stream of mental states. But it's not we, it's not I. I mean, you can use the words, I'm not chastising you for using the words, but the important thing is that we realize that they're not under our control. And I think this isn't something we can appreciate through logic or through listening. It's something you really have to practice. I mean, most people will go away from this still thinking that there is an I, that these are mine, and still trying to control things. But yeah, not under our control, not trying to control things, not trying to force. Not trying to force things to be the way we want. I mean, why should they be the way we want? Why shouldn't we just accept them for what they are? Acceptance, right? I mean, that's what Second Life is all about. Accept people however they are. Acceptance hard. Yeah. Is acceptance the denial of self? Yes, in the sense that I'm putting it. I mean, acceptance is saying to yourself that it's fine the way it is. Denial of self is denying that you have any control over it. But no, I suppose there's no need to come out and say there is no self or I have no self. I mean, that's just a view that we're not heading towards views. The thing about acceptance is the realization or the giving up of the desire to control. That's all that's important. That's really what we mean by non-self or by not self. We're not trying to create views in people's minds that there is no self, or I have no self, or this is just a fatalistic, deterministic reality. We're trying to give up our desire to force things, our need to control. I think that's a problem with Second Life, is we get this idea that we can control things. And so real life can often, I suppose, can probably become pretty difficult. Because it's not like that. Although this place can be aggravating as well, let me tell you, trying to create an umbrella for myself was very, very difficult. Zeno, you've got to see my new umbrella. 26 prims. Okay, where are we? You don't think SL is a manifestation of a hell realm? I wouldn't say that. Yeah, well, I've only been here a week, so you'll have to give me more time to ponder that one, I think. Is it a manifestation of a hell realm? No, I think that's an off-the-cuff question. I don't think you really believe that, do you? I mean, hell is a very terrible, terrible place where there's no happiness, no pleasure whatsoever. Yeah, in hell you can't sit here and meditate. There's no Dhamma talks in hell, let me tell you. What is happy? Happiness is peace. To love is to lose. I like acceptance. No, I think love is a very happy state. I think if it's true love, for sure. I think often the problem is we don't understand what is true love. Love which is unconditional, which is limitless. Yeah, but babies are often very unhappy as well. Although apparently the reason babies cry is not because they're unhappy. It's an interesting phenomenon. It's simply a reaction, but that's a whole other topic. For love to exist, its opposite must exist also, no? Yeah, I don't know about that. Not in the same individual. Love can't exist with its opposite. Love and hate cannot exist in the same mind. And the more love you create in your mind, the less hate you have. Delaney, I think, has some experience on this one. I'll have to take your word on it. Yeah, I haven't ever been a mom in this life. Okay, well, if possible, I'd like to take a short break now. I've been talking for a while and I need a glass of water. But if anybody wants to, we could either continue on here in 5 minutes, or you're welcome to come back to my new and wonderful kuti donated by the wonderful Zeno. Thanks a lot, Zeno, for your work. It's a great thing. Yeah, please just give me a second here. I'll be right back, okay? I'm just going to go get a glass of water. And then I'll answer more questions.